Hi, and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. Today, a question of identity.
The Ayatollah Khamenei said Mr. Rushdie and everyone involved in the publication of his book should be murdered. Now one of the Ayatollah's aides has offered £1 million to anyone who will do it.
The day of the fatwa, one that Akhil Bilgrami remembers well. The Indian-born philosopher took to his study for two feverish days and nights to compose an extraordinary essay titled What is a Muslim? In which he addressed identity, religion and resentment. It's just been republished and remains resonant a quarter of a century later as the West struggles to accommodate religious commitment. Akhil Bilgrami is Professor of Philosophy at Columbia University. Akhil Bilgrami, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone.
It's nice to be here.
Now, your background in philosophy is in areas such as the philosophy of mind and language, which in themselves have a number of different disputes, but your view of reference has widened quite considerably over the years to take in bigger socio-political cultural issues such as identity. Tell me about why this is important and whether this is now the main game in town for thinkers and public intellectuals.
You know, I do think something like that is true. And part of the reason for that is that many of the social sciences in the English-speaking world have sort of abdicated their interest and focus on value-oriented issues in their subjects. They've also abdicated their interest in the history of their subjects. So, for instance, in economics, you can't really take a course in the history of economic thought, for instance. And I think philosophy is poised to pick up the slack and take on a whole range of themes in the social sciences, which, due to the narrowing of the social sciences themselves, are not really being done in, at least in English-speaking departments of the social sciences. So I do think it's an exciting time to be doing philosophy, because there's all this work that has fallen to subjects like philosophy. And philosophers are broadening out. And my own interest brings together some of my work on the nature of practical reason, but applies it now to more urgent issues of contemporary concern.
Mm. Urgent issues, identity in the modern world, that's an urgent issue.
It is, because I think liberal doctrine and liberal polities find it very hard to cope with identity issues. And for a long time, people were very skeptical of identity issues. And to this day, I find colleagues saying, oh, I can't make any sense of the notion of identity. It's so vague and so sprawling. And there's something to that. I think people use the term. It's become a glamorous term. But they don't have a very rigorous sense of what they intend by it. And so it's a good thing for a subject that aspires to rigor, like philosophy, analytic philosophy, and philosophy generally, to bring its tools to study it. And I think it is a matter of contemporary concern, because people have started for some time now, 40 years, been mobilizing themselves in the public sphere, in the polity, on the basis of their identities. And some of it has made it very hard for liberal constitutions, liberal polities to cope with.
Hmm. Identity politics is certainly the big thing. You talk there that there's a bit of confusion. Philosophy can perhaps pull this apart. But one of the things that seems to happen with identity is it seems to merge the notion of the person and the idea, the metaphysical idea of what makes identity. There's an ethical and a metaphysical crossing over there. So you are what you are, and it becomes an ethical kind of question. Is that an issue in the way that we understand identity and identity politics, and in the way it's discussed in the public arena?
Yes. You know, there's these broad metaphysical issues which are about what makes you and me, say, different from stones and trees, or for that matter, dogs and frogs. So they're questions of that kind. Are we special just because we have larger brains, or are we special because we have capacities for moral judgment? And I think those are very broad general questions about how to individuate the concept of a person. But then there are specific issues that are more immediately relevant to the urgent concerns in politics, and that is, what makes me an Indian, or what makes me a heterosexual, or what makes me a Muslim? And these are the concerns which have now become very central to politics because people have mobilized themselves on firm commitments to being a Muslim, say, or an Indian. And these are transitory, but the transitions are long. So, for instance, it was very important to be counted as an Indian when you were struggling against British colonial rule. So you saw yourself as an Indian in some nationalist identity. Now, one would expect that that would lapse once India won freedom, but now it's been revived in terms of Hindu nationalism and Muslim backlash against it. And so it surfaces and resurfaces as, you know, with historical events. And I think one of the main reasons why it's so pressing today is not because of liberation movements in national struggles and so on, but because of immigration. Mm. And that's a new and interesting phenomenon of the post-Second World War period, especially because European economies were reconstructing after the destruction of the Second World War. And they had lost a lot of their labor force, manpower, as they called it. And so they allowed in people from erstwhile colonies to come and work, and in fact invited them in. And they came in large numbers, and then they brought their families because they couldn't just come as single males and stay for very long. So that set up a whole set of issues about identity, which, you know, segues into issues of multiculturalism, secularism, which we're faced with now.
Mm. You like take that firmly, the way of understanding that, very much in a historical materialist process, that the identity finds itself in relation to something that happens externally and community works around that. And I think that's what your belief of religion is. But do you think that undercuts an essential basis to why people want to subscribe to their religion, particularly, say, Islam, which seems so foundational?
Yeah. You're certainly right that there is a less contingent, less historically situated instinct in human beings, which is pretty universal, to find a sense of belonging and solidarity in a community. That goes very deep in us. Family just doesn't do it. We need something larger, and we need something which is non-trivial, so it has a public profile as well. And I think a lot of the appeal of religion today in many parts of the world, it's not just Islam, if you take the heartland of America, I think it's a very fascinating question to ask why. I believe America's maybe, it's a secularist country, but it's not very secularized because religion is everywhere in the heartland. And on the question of identity, you know, what I feel is a very important thing to try and see, Europe, the history of Europe was based on a very invidious deployment of identity. We tend to forget that because these things have emerged with immigration and so on, but after the Westphalian Peace in Europe, you needed a new legitimation for the state, state power. And you couldn't just say it's the divine right of the person, of the monarch who personified the state anymore, right? So you needed a justification for state power, and it was done through nationalism. And the standard ploy for it was to find an external enemy within, and hate it, despise it, subjugate it, and say the nation is ours, not theirs, right? And this was done to the Jews, to the Irish, Protestants in Catholic countries, Catholics in Protestant countries. This is the history of Europe. This is nation building in Europe since the 17th century. And we forget that Europe, in that sense, set up these majoritarian identities to really develop the notion of a nation and a nation state. And that's our liberal background. Liberalism, secularism came as a way of trying to correct this damage.
Hmm.
But this is the history of the West. And I think that we now find it being replayed with majorities, minorities, it's not due to immigration issues.
This is interesting because you're laying out a framework there where there in fact is a now another group which needs to somehow be singled out and told that perhaps doesn't belong. But you also say that there are some special peculiarities that are in Muslim communities, conflicts in Muslim communities that traditional philosophers don't understand and don't get a sense of, particularly traditional moral philosophy. What might that be, and how does that work?
On the assumption that nobody is a sort of monster of consistency, we have conflicting values, conflicting commitments. instincts that are in tension with one another. I mean, I do think fundamentalist populations, I mean, groups, fundamentalist groups, probably are not very conflicted, or at least they've worked themselves up into a position where they just think Islam and nothing else, or Islam in its originary form, you know, in the 7th century. But ordinary Muslims, by and large, I mean, that's a fragment of the Muslim populations of the world. Ordinary Muslims, by and large, are deeply conflicted. And so it's an inner conflict within the heart of most Muslims that they often despise the fundamentalist amidst them. But they feel somehow that they're letting the side down if they are critical of their own people. And how to diagnose that really requires understanding colonial history, which has got its current manifestations too. I mean, we haven't gotten rid of a lot of this form of dominance. But centuries of colonial rule. You see, here's a very interesting thing. Islam and Christendom were enemies for centuries. And there was a health in that hostility. Throughout the Crusades, I mean, there's never been a more vilifying, hostile, violent set of relations between two civilizations than during the long period of the Crusades. But that was a period in which both sides influenced each other in science, in philosophy, in the whole intellectual, cultural sphere. So they were robustly equal foes. But with Napoleon's campaigns in Egypt and the British conquest of India, and where there were large Muslim populations, in fact, India was ruled by Muslims when the British arrived, that whole set of relations changed. It was now no longer a clash of civilizations, but a conquest. And when Huntington says there's a clash of civilizations, that's just a grotesque misrepresentation, because it's a conquest passing off as a clash. When you have a clash, they're equal foes.
It's a mismatch, you're saying.
Yeah, it's a mismatch. And so identities form in a very specific way. They form as a defensiveness against the master. And so when people discover Islam or invoke Islam in a sense of defeat and powerlessness, that's the notion of identity that I think mobilizes them in a way that is completely unhealthy in some ways. And so ordinary Muslims may hate the fundamentalists amid them, but they feel we've had this whole history where the real enemy is somebody else, the West as it might be. And so they're loath to criticize their own people because they feel they're letting the side down against some other external enemy. I think that has to be navigated, studied, and, well, philosophers don't do that sort of thing. It should be done by historians, social scientists, and philosophers should get together with them. And, you know, these things should be studied from different angles.
However, conceptually, you also talk about fundamental commitment. I've tried to work out what that actually means or what you mean by that in regard to perhaps your thesis on post-colonialism and colonialism. What is fundamental commitment in the Muslim community and why is that an issue?
You have to sophisticate this, but one simple way to think of identity in terms of fundamental commitments is when you find yourself, you and I, in ordinary speech and life, find ourselves saying, you know, I wouldn't recognize myself if I did this. So in British schoolboy identity, you say, I wouldn't recognize myself if I betrayed my mate. That's British schoolboy identity. It wouldn't be me. If I just betrayed somebody who was my classmate or something, snitched on him, it wouldn't really be me. I couldn't recognize myself, right? And I think that goes very deep. That sort of commitment goes very deep. And I think people say, I couldn't recognize myself if I sort of succumbed to the lifestyles and cultures of the place where I've landed through immigration and completely gave up belief in this and these rituals or practices. People do say things like that. And there's a very fascinating thing that Khomeini, the Ayatollah, said once. He said, you know, we are bound to be affected by the pernicious modernity all around us, even we Ayatollahs, even we Orthodox Shiites. And he said, so what we should do is tie ourselves to the mast. That's not his phrase, it's my way of putting it. But we should entrench Islam in such a way, he said, that even when we weaken by the spread of modernity, we will be living by Islam. Now, I find that a very fascinating thing. It's a bit like saying all change in us would be a weakening.
It's an insurance policy, quite a strong one, isn't it? You have to stick to the game.
You have to stick to the game, that's right. And so you shouldn't, even if you do change, you should have entrenched things in such a way that you're not actually living by the changed views, but by the views you've entrenched. I find that that's like Ulysses and the Sirens, right? I might be seduced by the Sirens, but I should tie myself to. Now, that, I think, is a way of understanding how deep the commitments are, how fundamental commitments are. And we shouldn't scoff at it, because liberalism has an identity. When we say that rights are different from other values, what we are saying that, so why is free speech a right rather than just another value, like the hundreds of other values we have? What makes it special? Well, one of the things that makes it special is that we say we should elevate it in such a way that if we thought we would change, you know, suppose some horrible neo-Nazis came around us and we wanted to censor them, right? We have elevated free speech to such a right that we will not allow ourselves to censor them. It's exactly the same as what Khomeini is saying. It's just with different values.
It's interesting. You're equating the two. Is there a relativism in there, do you think? I mean, because one really does tie you to a set of values which, you know, might be outgrown, society's changed, people want something else, as opposed to a system which attempts some mechanism for continual openness and continual toleration, I think is probably the best way to put it. Are those two equivalent in the way that you've put them side by side?
Well, I mean, liberalism wants openness and toleration, but it has the same attitude towards free speech that Khomeini has towards Islamic values. So what I'm saying is that the notion of identity is something that's general, and even liberals have that notion, right? It's just that they have different values. One has the fundamental commitment to free speech. The other has to, say, Sharia laws or whatever it might be. Again, relativism is a problem for every view. I mean, nobody is going to have a glib and ready answer to the question, well, you know, I mean, people from different cultures will have different commitments, and how to navigate those is a problem that every view about ethics or politics is going to be faced with.
Akhil Bilgrami on Islam, Identity, and Living in the West. Our guest today on The Philosopher's Zone.
Seems to be the big question in Western societies. Here in Australia, there is an enormous amount of talk about Muslim communities, how they fit in with the general Australian populace. Clearly, these clashes are going to be quite egregious in places like the West, and won't be perhaps as big an issue from the source countries. I mean, somehow we need to all live together. And I know you don't want to give a glib answer, but how does one negotiate that?
Yeah, I think that's the hard issue on the multicultural front and on immigration. And in a sense, it divides into two. One is the hard case, and one ought to be a simple case, except that people are sort of boneheaded about it. So on matters of diet and dress and things like that, I mean, I think those relatively shallow, I mean, that's a tendentious way of putting it, but relatively shallow issues of culture, I think it's preposterous for a government to say you can't wear this form of dress or eat this kind of food. But, you know, when France does that kind of thing, I think it's a kind of mad dog secularist view. But the fact is that, taking Islam in particular, is that Islam is defined in many ways, at least after a certain period, constituted by the law. And in this respect, it's like Judaism. So the law matters a lot. It's a legally constituted cultural phenomenon, the Islamic religion. And when you have that, then there might be a clash between laws, right? So the immigrant populations come, they have a commitment to law. So it's law versus law. There's the liberal law of the land they've come to. They have their own laws. And that's when it's not a shallow dispute. It's a real, really hard dispute. And, you know, I've written about this. In the aftermath of Rushdie, there was this surface because free speech became the issue in Britain. And my view on this is that the government of the host country, it's a duty on its part to understand, first of all, that the immigrants are very conflicted. They do have commitments to the Sharia, many of them anyway. And also they have commitment to other values, which may be at odds with their commitment to the Sharia. And what home governments and home cultures should be doing, or host cultures should be doing, is to see if they can in some way encourage the values that are opposed to some of the fundamentalist commitments, say to censorship or blasphemy and so on, and get people around to overcoming their internal conflict. So lots of Muslims are committed to the Sharia and to censoring blasphemy, but they have all sorts of other commitments which seem to go against that, they themselves. And what we need is not just to plunk down rights. I use the term conceptual vernacular, a conceptual vernacular, not a natural language. You don't have to speak to them in their language. But lots of immigrants do, in fact, see the point of freedom and speech in speech. But you have to find a conceptual vernacular to tap that, because they don't have the vocabulary of rights, and they see it as an alien rhetoric. We don't do that often enough. I mean, I think we just plunk down rights. We've got a very limited rhetoric ourselves. We don't understand the conceptual vernaculars where they too might have instincts and cognitive inclinations or value inclinations towards things which are freedom of speech and so on. And if we tap that and steer them to see the point of their own commitments as being critical of their commitment to the Sharia. You know, I really do believe that if you put a microphone to someone's face, a Muslim's face, say anywhere in Bradford or Tehran even, they're never going to say, yes, we should get rid of the Sharia. But if you look at how much the Sharia plays a role in their lives, it's virtually zero. You know, people like Dawkins and all say 80% of America believes in that the world was created in 6 days, you know, a few thousand years ago. But, you know, so if you put a microphone to somebody's face in Nebraska and say, do you believe in creationism? They'd say yes. I have talked to any number of such people. Within 20 minutes, they're saying, oh, leave me alone, it's a metaphor. And it just gives people like Dawkins and all a kind of open season for all their scorn of personal belief, which I think is just invidious. I'm an atheist, but I think people like Dawkins are one of the more, you know, unseemly part of our intellectual culture.
You talk about Muslim communities themselves, in terms of their own identities, learning to speak in the first person and not the third person. Why is that consequential, and what does it mean?
Right. Yes, that's a point I've made which has been critical of Muslims, including Muslim intellectuals and academics. You know, there's a great tendency amongst Muslims, and I'm from a Muslim background, so I sort of observe this amongst ourselves. There's a great tendency for us to say, well, we are like this because of the colonial past and because of the racialism against, say, the North African Muslims in the banlieue of Paris. And so there's a constant stress. We are like this because of so-and-so. And I feel that that is to treat yourself as an object of history and being sort of shaped by the causal tendencies of history. And that's really to see yourself as you might see another person. When you say, we are like this, you're stepping outside of yourself and observing yourself. But the fact is, we also should think in the first person. And that's when our self-critical capacities will come in. If we just understand ourselves too well from the outside, we would have lost our sense of agency and self-criticism. It's good to understand yourselves, but then you also have to be in the first person and say, should we be like this? Should we be so shaped by our past? You know, Sartre raised this question. Sartre hated psychoanalysis. Why? Because he thought it was a matter of bad faith. Right? You keep saying, I'm like this because my father was like this, my mother was... And he says, that's you as an object, shaped by your past. But what about you in the present, in the first person? Do you endorse being like this, or do you think you ought to change it? And then you, of course, take on a completely different set of angles on yourself, which are not in the third person, but as agentive. And I feel that Muslims ought to really, you know, there's come a time when you have to just defect from third person understanding of yourself. Otherwise, in a way, if you understand yourself too well, you paralyze yourself.
Akhil Bilgrami, I could talk to you for hours. There's so much to talk about, but I think we might just leave it there for today. Thank you for coming in and talking to us.
Thank you, Philosopher
Zone. A careful mind in action. Akhil Bilgrami, Johnsonian Professor of Philosophy at Columbia University, grappling with the big questions of cultural and religious identity in the modern world. Thanks to the team, Diane Dean and Michelle Watts. I'm Joe Gelonesi. More next week in The Zone.